interests really stem from exploration and volunteerism and in terms of engagement. That's my past. But I was also, so I spent a lot of time looking at hospital records, which not even has a copious amount of supply. But I was also quite interested in notions of national myth, and particularly of wartime trains. I have a record of working in that particular area. And I was struck when I started to research this about the almost unanimity of opinion amongst medical and political historians about the rise of a kind of mass movement almost, which drove forward, either drove forward policy formation during the war, in the aftermath of the Beveridge Report, or provided political cover for politicians who wanted to make that change. There's a variety of views as to how change occurred, and some argue that it's very much institutionally driven, i.e. by medics or by politicians. Some, like Jacobs, for example, argue that so strong was that public pressure for change that politicians effectively had no choice at all but to instigate that change. What people highlighted, policymakers and historians subsequently, has been the kind of bad sides of existing, particularly hospital provision. And the hospitals, I don't know how much you know about the interwar system. I'm assuming some do and some don't. But it would be basically described as quite a disparate system. Hospitals which are voluntary or charitably driven, or hospitals which fall in the public sector. But in both cases, critics and historians particularly have argued that there are serious shortcomings in that provision, that for voluntarism, it was charitable-based, it had that strong charitable impulse, if you like, which large numbers of people found to be demeaning, that hospitals and health should not be reliant upon charity as an essence, but that states and society generally should take more responsibility for health provision. And on the other hand, on the other side, you had a public hospital system which derived from the old workhouses. Many hospitals in 1939 are still located physically in workhouses. And that negativity associated with public hospitals spilled over into how people thought about hospitals. So on the one hand, hospitals are charities. Charity, by and large, is not a good thing. Flag days are widely popular. On the other hand, they still suffer from that inheritance of the 1834 Poor Law Reform Act, the kind of Bastilles on the Hill, where I remember my granny, when she was ill, saying that she didn't want to go into hospital because her memories were that hospitals were places not only where you went to die, where were places where you were physically degraded or socially degraded. And what struck me, particularly in the recent debates about health reform, was how those images of that pre-NHS system have been used. This is my favourite, obviously, The Guardian, looking at Lansley's reforms. And this is Mark... God, I've forgotten his name. Mark Porter? Yeah. As I get older, my memory goes for names. Saying that what Lansley wanted to do was actually take hospital provision back to the dark days of the interwar period, where basically had a tattered safety net, where people ran out of entitlements, where health provision was not a right but almost a privilege, and a privilege bestowed by other people. This is what he actually said. And it seemed to me to capture at least part of the public anger, particularly coming from medics, about what Lansley was proposing to do. The kind of threat of privatisation, if you weren't careful, going down the road of Americanised systems, multi-sector provision, which of course is what you had in the interwar period, none of those sectors doing the job that they did. And the lack at the same time with a unified system, which of course is what nationalisation brought in. Right, just a kind of bit of background, because I'm assuming a partial knowledge. By the end of the interwar period, this is, I think it's 1938, I say two different types of hospitals really. The volunteer ones, ranging from big teaching hospitals through to small cottage places, which are basically staffed by GPs, providing about a third of all hospital beds. These guys rely on public subscription, traditional charitable sources of income, income from community actions like fairs and galas, and also, as Martin has shown, I think, in his work over the last 10 years, increasingly on contributory schemes paying tuppence or threepence a week, which provides basically a form of private medical insurance for you and your family. By 1939, these cover about 10 million people and maybe another 12 million dependents. And are extraordinarily popular. And that's the other thing, I guess, best to make. They specialise essentially in acute medicine. So surgery, immediate medical needs, accident emergency and outpatients. And also in specialist areas like maternity care, eye hospitals, children hospitals, all these are covered by the volunteer sector. The other side, it's like, is the public hospital system, which is a tad more complicated because the 1930s it becomes almost increasingly diverse. So under the 1929 Local Government Act, local councils for the first time take over, or can take over, responsibility for essentially public hospitals. And some do and some don't, particularly in London. The LCC invests heavily in the public hospital system, financially and emotionally and politically. But others remain unattached, still really run by the inheritors of the Poor Law Guardians, the public assistance committees. And these hospitals generally care more. Me. We have to walk around to get it to work.
I do this in
front of your screen still.
Okay. It's a good job not reading my notes, isn't it, really?
Let there be light.
So they care for long term chronic cases, mentally ill, particularly the elderly. They'd be positives for large numbers of aged folk. But also, again, particularly places like London, they're beginning to acquire an acute capacity, becoming modern hospitals. So that some of the best local authority-controlled hospitals are verging on being as good as the voluntary sector. Local authority hospitals have a statutory duty to admit local citizens. They're also staffed by paid doctors. In the voluntary sector, there is some paid staffing, but the consultants, the high flyers, give their services basically for free. And they use their status in hospitals to build up their own private practices. So it's quite a different system. It's quite a disparate system, and I guess one of the main impetuses for reform, driving in the late 1930s and through the war into the post-war period, is to try and find a mechanism by which this disjointed system can become more united. And maybe also to get away from the kind of standard image that we have of hospitals as being places where you simply go to die. We talked about this today, they still are, of course. And to get away from that poor law inheritance, that stigma, which still pervades the public boards, particularly public hospitals. The other part of this equation is how you pay and how you react to your hospital. This is a really good book if you ever get a chance to read it. Bella Aronovich was a patient in a voluntary hospital and then later a local authority hospital, Paul Law Hospital, in the late 1920s and early 1930s. I've talked about voluntary hospitals being funded by contributions and by contributory schemes. The other side of it also is that there's if you don't have that voluntary insurance, then you're assessed on the basis of means to pay. And this is Bella's account of her encounter with the almoner. The almoners become social workers, but at this time, primarily their duty, their responsibility is to find out how much you're capable of paying towards the cost of your treatment. So they'll go into your means, not just your means, but your family's means. And this is heavily disliked. I guess it's one of the key reasons why contributory schemes begin to flourish in the way that they do, because they protect contributors from this kind of inquisition. You go into hospital, you're a member of the contributory fund, the box is ticked, you don't have to pay, the bill is passed on to somebody else. But if you don't have that kind of cover, then the inquisition, if you like, starts. Poor people are still basically treated for nothing. Those in between us are assessed on how much they can afford to pay. And it's the notion of somebody assessing, somebody inquiring into personal need and your personal circumstances, which large numbers of working people find very, very intrusive. I'd also add to that that actually local authority hospitals are doing the same. So it's not just a voluntary system. And one of the arguments I want to make is actually when we were looking to reform, the thing that bogged people most centred not about on type of hospital and about payment systems. What people really wanted was a unified system in that respect. Okay, so that's a bit of background history. That's by local Nottingham and Notts Hospital Chapley Committee, which is then becomes a contributory fund in 1930. Okay. It's generally held. I mean, if you read people like Webster, Klein, Batt, there is this movement towards a nationalised system. Yes. People were very unhappy about notions of health and charity being run together in the same sentence, in the same equation. And this poll, this is a poll conducted in 1939, Gallup, would suggest that my argument is spurious. Actually, what people wanted was a transfer away from charitable status through to hospitals being supported as a public charge. There can be no doubting those figures. Can you just read the question and hold that in your mind? I'm a great believer in answering open questions. I'm not sure that question is open. It seems to be slightly leading. It's like, when did you stop beating your wife sort of question. Nonetheless, that's the kind of data that historians have built upon when they're constructing a kind of negative image of how we understand that particular past. Stop doubting that the NHS, when it's introduced, is extraordinarily popular. It's the best thing that it's arguably the best thing that the Labour government did, most popular thing, most appreciated thing. That too would suggest that what was there previously was not what people wanted. Okay. We have a problem with that. As historians, we've all been brought up on the importance of beverage, the kind of founder of the welfare state, the slayer of five great giants, and I won't list them because I always forget to. It's ignorance, poverty, idleness. That's four. Go on, fifth. No, one. Yeah, whatever it is, anyway. We, it's always been agreed, or we thought we knew, that Bedford is very popular. Well, it's extraordinary. It's a government publication which sells something like 640,000 copies. I know of no other publication that sells that many, approaching that many number. When people are asked, when they've heard of it, something like 95% of the population say yes. When people are asked whether they approve of it, about 80, don't write these figures down because I'm kind of making them up, but it's about right, about 87, 88% of people approve of it. When you ask them whether it's going to be implemented, the figure drops a bit because they don't really trust politicians. When you ask them what's in it, there's a problem because large number of people have no idea at all. But they think basically that beverage is a good idea. That, I guess, where's the flashing light? Is the light? Is it the top one?
Red thing at the top, yeah.
That figure is odd, I think. And one of the arguments recently has been that Labour isn't elected in 1949 with a whopping majority because of its support for beverage, but because of a fear of the past of the 1930s and the rejection of the peace. And people like Nick Duritzo have used figures from things like beverage and the lack of knowledge to argue that actually welfareism was not a primary consideration and that people by and large voted from ignorance or through ignorance. Setting that to one side, health doesn't score, really. It's third. Old age pensions are much more of a concern. Family allowances more so. Health, not something that's high on people's immediate priorities, which is surprising. It's not what we've been told, because what we're talking about here is the jewel and the crown of the welfare state, and widely seen as that. That's the other key stat, in my opinion. Okay. Ask Gallup, or Gallup are asking what people care about most in the 1940s and in the just after the war, 1944 and 1946. What they don't seem to care about that much is social security, health and education. What does that mean? It's problematic because it means that people care about the immediate things that are going to affect them right away more. So they care about employment and particularly about demobilisation. They care about a house. You know, no houses built for 6 years, large numbers destroyed or made rendered uninhabitable. Earlier marriage, therefore more and more or increased numbers of private families, there's an acute housing shortage. So that their immediate concerns are not, if you like, the bigger things. They're the kind of list of priorities of food, accommodation, jobs, and then we'll think about everything else. So those figures in themselves, whilst giving a snapshot, perhaps don't wholly prove that health provision or a revised system of health provision is the immediate priority. You can look at it in a variety of different ways. What do you think is going to be most likely to discuss in the general election? Well, again, social security, education, not big players. Again, it's the things you might expect. Housing, unemployment, which score most in people's immediate priorities in terms of their consciousness. That doesn't mean to say that people don't care about hospitals or don't think that the hospital system is in need of reform. It just means that at the time they've got other more pressing things on their minds. Asked about what they feel about hospitals, Mass Observation, who's a social survey organisation, it's set up immediately before the war and works through to the mid-1950s. They do a number of very valuable wartime immediate post-war surveys on people's reactions to medicine. And particularly because they're not a neutral organisation, they have a very clear social and political agenda, which is to basically push a progressive reformist political front. So they ask people what they feel about hospitals, and most people say they're moderately satisfied. But at the same time, that we could do with some changes. They don't specify what changes there might be, except really the most frequent complaint goes back again to the system, not at the hospitals themselves, but on how treatment is paid for, and also who's paying. One of the other big concerns which comes out of the data is that people want to feel that they're being treated fairly and that everybody's paying their fair share. So the success of the contributory schemes, they are very obviously, they're very popular. Of all the voluntary association stuff in this period, they have by far and away the highest membership and probably the highest satisfaction rate at the same time. What really gets up people's noses is that they contribute to these schemes to keep hospitals going, that their neighbour doesn't, but he still gets treatment. So it's a focus really on how treatment is paid for. That seems to be a very clear priority. And also that they don't think there should be two separate schemes. Under the 1911 National Insurance Act, the government sets up a system whereby you can, if you earn the wage of a skilled male worker or below, you can get access to local GP services. It's called a panel system. You register with your local GP. And the money you pay through National Insurance covers for the cost of your treatment. It only covers for your cost. It doesn't cover for the costs of your wives, husbands, children, if they aren't paying National Insurance. And one of the big problems identified by the respondents is that the money you pay as National Insurance doesn't provide you automatically with access to hospital care. And what large numbers of people are arguing for, and again it goes back to payment, is that there ought to be some form of unified system of National Insurance or a compulsory association with a contributory fund so that everybody pays the same, or according to the almost the same, and that it covers not only for hospitals but for GPs as well. If people are so unhappy, if there is this grounds, I'm arguing, I don't want to overturn all your opinions but or views on that past, but what I do want to attack really is this insistence that there's this groundswell of anger about the poor state of interwar health provision, particularly hospital provision. If people were that angry, if services were that bad, then how is it that we have figures there which Andrew Lansley would kill for? Satisfaction rates under Lansley dropped about 60%. These guys are recording figures in terms of how they've been treated, that are around the 75% level. That's the key figure. Men, because men don't moan as much as women, apparently, or at least that's how the survey we reported, are more easily satisfied than are women. There's actually an explanation for that, which is, let me go in the order of the slides. Skilled working men are the most satisfied, or the skilled working class are the most satisfied. These are the guys that really are covered by the contributory fund. So that figure indicates actually that system seems to be working reasonably well. The people who are less satisfied are the middle classes and women. Why? Well, for the middle classes, the answer is apparently simple. It's because they can't get free ready access to the big voluntary hospitals because they're earning too much. What you do have during this period is a growth of private provision within those hospitals, in pay wards and pay beds. But again, there's a dissatisfaction with that, A, because there aren't enough beds, and B, because whilst you pay for the treatment, you're not treated as a private person. There's some wonderful lines in the archives in Nottingham which talk about people who are paying for treatment, and the payment never really covers the actual cost of the treatment. It ranges between 4 and 12 guineas a week. They're paying this money, and the doctors are still being grumpy with them. The nurses aren't doing what they're supposed to do, which is act as almost unpaid servants. That if somebody phones them up, then the nurse won't drop everything and go fix the phone. So they're paying some of the costs of private medical care, but they're not being treated as private patients. They're getting the same food in many cases. And they're also getting landed with large bills at the end. So, you know, for consultation, for use of hospital equipment. So what they think they're going to pay is not what they end up paying. For women, it's because of a rising expectation for good quality maternity care. And neither system at this stage is providing. More people are having their babies in hospital. They're acquiring the hospital habit, but the standard of care, particularly accommodation provided, is inadequate. There's some wonderful stuff in the National Archives about women complaining bitterly about when they're waiting to go into labour, they can hear the screams of the women that are giving birth. And the suggestion would be that they provide soundproof booths. They don't. So access there is problematic. And there's a sense that a kind of social injustice, that rich people are getting significantly better care than poor people. And that's driving this general level of dissatisfaction. The other indicator which is worth looking at briefly is that unsatisfactory levels or dissatisfaction levels run fairly evenly across the three sectors: voluntary, municipal, and national. By national, I mean those hospitals which have been taken into the emergency medical scheme, which is designed to cater for civilian and service casualties, and for those who've been evacuated or have moved to another place for war work. It's the beginnings, if you like, of an embryonic national health service. It's something that Martin and I would very much like to look at in the not-too-distant future. And people have argued, Webster et al. Have argued, that it's this national system which provides the forerunner, a unified system, but also the birth, or see the birth of a kind of system which becomes later than the National Health Service. So these people, there's lots of temporary accommodation built, there's a national wage scale structure introduced. If you like, it has all the imprints of what is going to follow in 1946 and then later formalised in 1948. But in terms of satisfaction levels, there's no great difference. How do people think hospitals ought to be run? Well, I guess I'm thinking myself in the foot here slightly, because when asked that question, this is again 1943 sample, most people say they would like a national hospital system, the emergency medical service or something which follows from that. So what's my argument? My argument is that if you then start to add up the other alternatives, you get pretty much close to the same kind of number. It's a fairly even break. Now that's perhaps an odd way of looking at it. It doesn't deny that the single most popular choice is a national hospital system. But there are other surveys. One of the beauties of studying this period is there are lots of surveys. Again, asked a similar kind of question, public or existing, the numbers split almost evenly. So 42% argue or vote for a national system, and 42% vote for either a voluntary or mixed hospital system of multiple providers. You get a different response depending on who you ask. Women are more tied to voluntarism and charity, I think, than men are. It's argued by people like Pat Fain that that's because they receive, as beneficiaries, immediate impact of this, and also that for many of them it's part of what they do in their daily lives, i.e. they're involved in raising money for charities. So more naturally predisposed towards it. Voluntary hospitals. I said that Mass Observation was not a neutral organisation. They do quite a lot of work on voluntary hospitals, again, what people think of them. One thing that comes out very clearly from the MO material is that your view about voluntarism and voluntary provision basically divides the nation. There are those on the one hand who really like not only the notion that it's locally controlled, but that it's paid for by the community, that it's or can be seen almost as our hospital, the people's hospital. And they quite like the idea that there's a strong sense that if it's funded in this particular way, then it's less likely to be not just status, but bureaucratized. It's going to be more friendly, it's going to be more caring, people are going to be more approachable because of the nature of the institution itself, where statement things quite frequently are looked at negatively because people, their experiences of the states are not always positive. Working people's contact with agents of the state quite frequently are anything but positive. Their contacts are with education, their contacts are with poor law guardians, busy bosses, red tape, it all comes out. But my basic point here is that this is Mass Observation not actually presenting a neutral evaluation. My maths tell me that means that roughly 2/3 think they're good and 1/3 think they're bad. But they say opinion is basically evenly divided. What you're hearing here is the beginnings of a reformer voice, which distorts actually what people think. It's a filter through what people think. Why do people like voluntary hospitals? Well, it's their long heritage, long tradition. Many of them were founded in the 1750s, 1760s. Sorry, can you see? Okay. And there is this interesting line here that people don't want the hospitals to be run by government. They're quite happy for them to be financed in that way, in part or in whole, but they don't want them to be run that way. Not so surprising. I mean, again, this is a wartime survey. For good or bad, the government, Britain becomes almost a totalitarian state during the war. I mean, it controls every part of your life. There's a wonderful quote by A.J.P. Taylor in his English History 1914-1945, where he says that if you're middle class before the First World War and you don't nick from your company, which is unlikely, you'll have no contact with any agent of the state at all through your lifetime. You provide for your own health, your own education, everything. If you think of the situation in 1943, that's completely different. The government controls your food, your transport, what you do with your lives. So I can understand perhaps this antipathy to direct government intervention. How do people think? I've done that already. Oh, sorry, we haven't. Looking at a class breakdown, it is classed. Sometimes that's reassuring. It means that people are actually thinking about the answers that they're giving. There you'll see that the big hitters across the classes, particularly the lower classes, skilled, working and unskilled, offer nationalised hospital system. In the middle classes, with their despite their reservations about access to voluntary hospitals, they are still much more embedded in the system, or a system of self-provision. So I'm not surprised that support there is higher than in other classes. If you look at it on a class breakdown, you'll see actually that support for a nationalised system is related directly to class. that the farther down the social scale you go, the more popular a nationalised system is. That, again, is not surprising. That figure there, it's a reflection, if you like, of how unskilled and semi-skilled people are treated in voluntary hospitals as almost as paupers, and at the same time reflection too of their lack of income, not just in total terms but in terms of regularity of source coming in. So these are the people who are least likely to be able to afford the tuppence or threepence a week to be paid through what are largely work-based contributory funds. But I think that in itself is actually quite instructive, that support actually varies significantly across class. Why do people, I'm saying that a large number of people do actually support a nationalised system, about 40%, why? It's intuitive, I guess. And this goes back again to how we should think about the answers which have been given to some of these questions. Sorry, that wasn't very clear. What I mean is that if you look at something like beverage, and that large number of people have no opinion as to why beverage is a good thing. In the same sense, when you ask them about a nationalised hospital system, most of them just accept that that's what it should be. It's an unreasoned response, just an instinctive response, which has in itself meaning, I think. Common response is that hospitals shouldn't have to depend on charity. That there would be greater efficiency in organisation, economies of scale, and two, that there's an acceptance that voluntary provided systems might not necessarily be capable of producing all of the cash which is necessary, and that in future they might limit their achievements. How do we think that hospitals ought to be paid for? There are two things to mention here. The first is that there's no clear correlation, which is surprising, between a response to how hospitals should be paid for and a response to which hospital systems would be best, which suggests a kind of certain ambiguity in the way people are thinking and organising their thoughts. But the message is fairly clear. Most people want either a national social insurance scheme, which is basically an extension of national insurance, or B, they want individual payment, which is an amalgam of direct payment or payment through a contributory fund. What they don't want is payment through direct taxation. And would you like to hazard a guess which system they end up with? That would be payment through direct taxation. Never think that politicians don't listen to what people want. So social insurance across the classes is most popular. Individual payment, again, it seems popular between amongst the middle classes and skilled workers. Again, surprisingly not popular with those people who have irregular income or low income base. Of those people who were patients, what do people think should be the rest of their paying for hospital treatment? Those who've been in voluntary hospitals, individual payment scores highly, much higher than, say, those who've been patients in municipal or national hospitals. But again, for those in national hospitals, it's social insurance which tops the mark. And indeed, it's the most popular response across all patients and all social classes. It's about, really, this idea that I already pay once, and what I ought to be doing is paying into a unified and overarching system. Okay, finally, because I must be running out of time. All right, how are we doing?
5 minutes.
Yeah, okay. One of the big robs about voluntarism is its reliance on things like flag days. And if you listen to opponents of that system at that time, including people like Beveridge, he writes this up in his lesser-known work, Voluntary Service, or
voluntary, whatever it's called, action. Thank you. I told you I've got a crap memory for names, dates. She's really good if you're a historian, it works really well.
What do they think about flag days? Unpopular. Less unpopular with women,
for the same kind of reasons that I already said.
Particularly unpopular with men, and particularly unpopular with skilled working men.
If you run the sentence, the nouns charity and hospitals together, for these people they give an overwhelmingly negative response.
And that's true even of those people who've been treated in voluntary hospitals. Flag days themselves seem to be innately unpopular. Attitudes to charity, I love this. It's that
really lights my candle. I could have this mental picture of this poor, timid young man having to flee for his life from a young, beautiful, flag-selling woman and being kind of embarrassed to say no. But, I mean, it's generally held from the surveys of the time that people try and avoid eye contact, walk the other way. I find myself doing it when I'm walking down Beeston High Street. Studious looking at my shoes or pretending to be dressed in the furniture shop. Nonetheless, there's a hierarchy of charities and hospitals and Fund for the Disabled find it significantly easier to raise money in this way than do other forms of charitable activity. This is Elizabeth McCallum, the new philanthropy in 1934. Every social worker knows it's easier to extract money for sickness, especially sickness amongst children, than for any other cause. And there's just one final point, I guess, that I'd like to think about, and that's the word and how we understand it. What my observation found was that the word charity, had acquired a pejorative overtone by the time you get to the 1930s. It's not quite as straightforward as that. Again, Pat Fain argues that it depends how charity is given, how it's received, whether it's offered with fellowship or whether it's imposed upon. But if you change the word, if you move the word from volunteerism or voluntary activity to charity, then significantly more people approve of voluntary activity than they do of charitable activity. So in some senses, it is much about the word as it is about the activity. I guess the point I would make is that what we're talking about by the time we get to the 1930s are hospitals which are voluntary hospitals rather than charitable hospitals. They're funded by a range of activity. And I must show you this before we start. This is Nottingham in 1928. Well, I'll show you it and then I'll have a quick chat. When people say that university students have a bad name, you ain't seen nothing yet. This is Nottingham University students. They raise about £1,000 a year through this type of activity. Not just the jumping up and down, but this is the Lord Mayor of Nottingham being kidnapped and held to ransom. Days as being unpopular activities, but this is street theatre. This is how they raise their money. They're going amongst the crowd collecting. And look at the size of the crowd. You know, if it's that unpopular, why are people there? Well, they're there to have a good time. It's a social event. And so much of voluntary activity at this time is built around this kind of structure, whether it's students jumping up and down on cars, whether it's organising galas, whist drives, or a big activity. My favourite is Nottingham's annual Egg Week. Would anybody like to, I've probably asked this question so many times, but would anybody like to hazard a guess at how many eggs Nottingham Hospital raises or collects in a year by the mid-1930s? Higher or lower? Well, if I said 50,000, would you be surprised? Yeah, well, actually, you can triple that. It's about 150,000 eggs a year. Coming from individuals giving 6 eggs to farmers giving thousands of eggs, from like allotment holders, you name it. And they not only do they give the eggs, but they give the pickling brine as well. It's a big activity. It's worth about 750 quid a year, which in terms of total income is actually quite high. So my point is that actually using the word charity, the reason why the first question was wrong is because it posits it as charitable activity, or reliance on charity, and charity is viewed negatively. But if you change the word to volunteerism, you get a much better response. So that's the question. Charity, no takers, change the word, you get a different response. It's about how people think they're cheap and not cheap. That's the real rub. I think that comes out very strongly. So my argument basically is that people don't care what type of hospital, they care about how it's paid for. And what they want is a unified system of payment. This is really the proof of the pudding. This is Bass Observation's own synopsis from that earlier survey. And it's not what you'd find in the standard history books. It's not how this story's been told. What they're saying is that half the population were opposed to change, a quarter disinterested. That doesn't surprise me. And about a quarter in favour of state intervention. I think those figures are for state intervention are slightly low. But Mass Observation explains it in a completely different way. It says that actually what people are afraid of is change. And they convince themselves that things aren't as bad as people tell them they are. And with things like health particularly, there's an obstacle to change. And Lansley obviously has found this out very strongly. Because the difference between Lansley and Beveridge and that is that Lansley has no simple message to sell. For people outside this room, if you ask them to explain to them what the Health and Social Welfare Bill is about, most of you will, well, a lot of them will say, I'm sorry, what bill? Large numbers will say, I don't know, but I don't like it. And some will say it's about cuts or privatisation, or some will say it's about GP commissioning. I did read on a recommendation Nick Timmins' account of the laboured passage of that bill. And the thing that really struck me was the line which said, if you can't sum it up in 2 sentences, then you're going to have a problem selling the argument. He couldn't do that. Beveridge can do that, and does do that. And yet still, that message doesn't get across, which suggests to me, actually, that opinions have all disaggregated and we've always been done. I'm not saying there aren't people in favour of change, there are. I'm just saying that the kind of change that most people are in favour of is a change of the system of payment, not a change of the system of governance. And that those in favour of any change at all, those numbers have been widely, widely exaggerated. What, of course, Mass Observation do is try to downplay that, and what historians have done, particularly Jacobs, is just cherry pick figures which suit his particular argument, which is by and large simply wrong. You shouldn't do that. But his line has been followed by most historians of health. If you look at people like Addison, they say that you can judge the fervour for reform based on the dissatisfaction with existing provision. My argument would be that there was no great dissatisfaction with existing provision. And indeed, that if you compare satisfaction rates for the pre-HNS system, I know this is problematic across time, but they're very comparable with figures that you'd find today. In some cases, over our recent past, significantly better. So before and after the NHS, there is a movement, sorry, let me start again. 1948, 49, when it first comes in, people feel a lot better about it. By the time they've lived with the system for 10 years or for 20 years, the levels of satisfaction actually are much the same as they were pre-war. And complaints against doctors, for a variety of reasons, have actually risen and risen quite sharply. That's partly because they can get legal aid to take the case. But it does go away from that differentiated view which we traditionally had. The final point, this is the Gemmell survey is done in mid-1950s. He's an American academic. He was determined to prove that the NHS system, which has been installed, has been very positive. And indeed, I mean, the argument is that more people, you know, three times as many people think it's got better than it's worse. But the key figure there is that 51% of people think it's about the same. And if you think at the level of dissatisfaction, particularly with GP services where before the war, where it's widely held that people on the panel, i.e. people who get their treatment paid for under national health, health insurance, are widely discriminating and they get a second-class system of care. And given that most people stick with their same GP, that if 50, about the same number of people think it's about the same, then that doesn't reflect particularly well on the National Health Service. Okay, I think that's it. Yes.